It is Friday, December the 22nd. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, strong message at the UN from the U.S. ambassador. Also, the U.S. vice president making a surprise visit to Afghanistan.
President Trump has unleashed the full range of American military might. We've lifted the restrictions that limited the effectiveness of our armed forces. So you can, as the president has said, fully and swiftly wage battle against the enemy.
Syria's humanitarian plight, plus a story to fit the season. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. The United Nations General Assembly has overwhelmingly adopted a resolution rejecting the U.S. decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and to move its embassy there. The non-binding resolution was adopted with 128 nations supporting the measure, 9 voting against it, and 35 countries abstaining. U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley to the U.N. repeated the Trump administration's threat it would take note of the countries which voted against its policy, and in her words, will remember it when they are called upon to once again make the world's largest contribution to the United Nations.
When a nation is singled out for attack in this organization, that nation is disrespected. What's more, that nation is asked to pay for the privilege of being disrespected. In the case of the United States, we are asked to pay more than anyone else for that dubious privilege. Unlike in some UN member countries, the United States government is answerable to its people. As such, we have an obligation to acknowledge when our political and financial capital is being poorly spent. We have an obligation to demand more for our investment.
Since taking office in January, President Trump has broken with the foreign policy of his predecessor by recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, refusing to certify Iran's compliance with the nuclear deal, pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords, and taking a more aggressive stance toward North Korea. We get more now on all of this from VOA correspondent Mario Mediallo, who tells us views about these foreign policy departures are mixed, with some welcoming the forceful projection of American power on the world stage, while others criticize what they see as a dangerous course for the United States.
It is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
It was an announcement that took many by surprise.
There is no alternative to the two-state solution. There is no plan B.
President Donald Trump's move, which unleashed protests, was a reversal of long-standing U.S. policy that Jerusalem's status must be decided by negotiation. It was also an example of how he's broken with former President Barack Obama.
This is the nature of the Trump presidency. It's not conventional. It's not always policy-based.
On North Korea, the Iran nuclear deal, the Paris Climate Change Agreement, Trump has moved the U.S. in a different direction.
You've seen that very clearly with regard to the war against ISIS in both Iraq and Syria. And ISIS has nearly been wiped out, actually, in both of those countries. You're seeing that with regard to North Korea, where there's a much more proactive, aggressive approach. Also on the Iran front as well.
While this forceful approach is what Trump promised his supporters, some critics say complicated situations like Iran require the diplomatic tool.
In the 70 years since the end of World War II, America has relied on two key tools for its security and standing in the world. One has been the strength of its diplomacy, and the other has been the strength of its armed forces. You're taking one of the tools off the table, the diplomatic tools, without really putting a well-thought-through and crafted policy as an alternative.
The United States will withdraw.
President Trump's other big break with his predecessor was in June, when he withdrew from the Paris Climate Change Agreement, making the United States the only country to reject the global pact.
To move away from the Paris Accord on climate without anything to replace it is, you know, a step back 10 years rather than looking at where we're going to be as a society and as an economy 10 years plus.
Despite this move, other observers say Trump has made fewer foreign policy changes than many expected based on his campaign rhetoric.
This is actually quite a traditional U.S. foreign policy approach, in that President Trump clearly rejects the idea of isolationism. Many analysts thought that this administration would be isolationist, that you would see America turning away from the world. You haven't seen that at all.
Disruptor or traditionalist, Trump's foreign policy moves are likely to keep adversaries and allies vigilant and even wary as the president enters his second year in office. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Vice President Mike Pence told Afghan President Ashraf Ghani on a secret visit to Afghanistan the U.S. is in the country until peace returns. Mr. Pence's surprise pre-Christmas visit was the first to the war-torn country by either President Trump or the Vice President, and it came as the Trump administration charts a pathway for ending the 16-year war in Afghanistan.
President Trump has unleashed the full range of American military might. We've lifted the restrictions that limited the effectiveness of our armed forces, so you can, as the President has said, fully and swiftly wage battle against the enemy. We've given you new authorities to directly target the terrorists and militants, no matter where they hide. And this Commander-in-Chief has empowered our battlefield commanders with the freedom and flexibility you need to win. Bureaucrats don't win battles. Soldiers do.
Vice President Pence was speaking at a rally-style event at Bagram Air Base. He also received briefings from military leaders, including General John Nicholson. He is the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan. In other news, authorities in Melbourne, Australia say the man arrested for injuring 19 people when he deliberately drove his car into a crowd of pedestrians has no known links to terrorism. Shane Patton, the acting chief commissioner for Victoria State Police, told reporters the suspect was a 32-year-old Australian citizen of Afghan descent. He said the man does have a known history of drug use and mental health issues.
He is a 32-year-old Australian citizen of Afghan descent. He is a person who is known to Victoria Police. He has historical assault matters. He is not currently on any bail or any corrections order or anything of the like, and has a history of drug use as well as mental health issues. We understand, as I said, this still is very early days, that he is on a mental health plan and receiving treatment for a mental illness. We are working through those to clarify that.
The suspect was arrested, and Patton said a 24-year-old man who was spotted recording the incident with his cell phone camera and later found to be carrying a bag of knives was also arrested. Patton reiterated that there is no preliminary indication the driver had any connection to international terrorism, but he said the investigation is ongoing.
We don't at this time have any evidence or any intelligence to indicate there's a connection with terrorism. And I just want to reiterate that. At this time, we don't have any evidence or intelligence to indicate a connection with terrorism. Having said that, however, we continue to support this investigation with our counter-terrorism command to ensure that there isn't that connection and that there is no ongoing threat. We have no evidence to suggest there is, but from a completeness perspective, that's what we're doing.
Victoria State Premier Daniel Andrews said four of the 19 victims are in critical condition, and he said one of the victims, a toddler, suffered a serious head injury. The incident is the second of its kind to take place this year in Australia's second largest city. Six people were killed when a car drove into a group of pedestrians in January. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. A senior United Nations official says people are dying because the Syrian government will not give the green light for an urgent medical evacuation from eastern Ghouta, a suburb of Damascus. Lisa Schlein is in Geneva with our report.
The United Nations has been asking the Syrian government for permission to transport patients from eastern Ghouta to Damascus for urgent medical treatment since May, to no avail. Special advisor to the UN Syrian envoy, Jan Egelen, says 494 people were on the priority list for medical evacuations drawn up 2 months ago.
That number is going down, not because we're evacuating people, but because they are dying.
At least 400,000 people are trapped in eastern Ghouta, which is besieged by President Bashar al-Assad's regime. UN humanitarian workers have been blocked from delivering food and other critical supplies to the civilians trapped there for months. Because of this deprivation, Egelen says 12% of children in the city are suffering from severe acute malnutrition, and one-third of malnourished children under 5 are stunted. He tells VOA he has confirmation that 16 people have died since the medical evacuation lists were resubmitted in November, but he adds that number is probably higher.
I fear during this Christmas and holiday season, there will be more deaths unless we get the evacuation going. They have to be evacuated to get the treatment they need to save their life.
Eastern Ghouta, which has been under siege since 2013, is only 15 kilometers east of Damascus. Egelen notes the Syrian capital has the hospitals needed to care for the wounded and critically ill patients. He says the city has enormous warehouses full of special nutritional therapeutic foods needed to treat acutely malnourished children. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It is time now to find out what's trending on social media with Andrew Palchewski.
Trending today, some big changes in social and digital media. Starting with Facebook, changing its tactics to fight fake news. Earlier this year, the social media giant introduced a new system to combat misinformation. Of course, as we've talked about time and time and time again, there's been a laser focus this past year on the role of social networks in spreading false information, particularly as it relates to the 2016 U.S. presidential election. As the links between Russia and those false news stories grow stronger and stronger, social media companies are doing more and more to preserve fact and remove falsehoods. So Facebook's new system, introduced in December 2016, allowed users to flag content as being fake or misleading. Facebook's goal in implementing the new system was to not only cut down on the false information swirling on the social network, but to empower social media users to flag the fake posts they regularly see. But that's not how this system worked out. Because according to an academic study, instead of rejecting stories flagged as false on social media, some people actually thought the stories had greater credibility. Basically, people were more willing to believe the stories they saw than Facebook. And that wasn't the only problem. Facebook says they didn't have enough human editors to monitor stories marked as fake, especially in countries where false information is a persistent problem online. So what's Facebook's solution to this? Rather than flagging news that's suspected of being fake, they're going to show related articles that question or disprove those claims. While Facebook notes that this new system didn't decrease the number of people clicking on a fake article, it did lower the number of shares that those articles got. Social networks are constantly fine-tuning how they work, from the content that you see to the ways that you interact with others. And this instance is no exception. In fact, while this is the latest change that Facebook has made regarding the information that you see, it will definitely not be the last. And another big change from Apple on how you use your phone, one that you probably didn't know about until this week. Because after some eagle-eyed iPhone users noticed that their phones were slowing down after the release of Apple's newest operating system, the company fessed up. Apple slows down older phones so they can better deal with newer software. Now, this doesn't happen all the time, only in instances where your phone's battery can't keep up with the software. Apple says if they didn't slow down your phone in that instance, the phone would just shut down completely. Apple said in a statement that they've made the change to their iPhone 6 and iPhone 7 series to deliver the best experience for customers, which includes overall performance and prolonging the life of their devices. After that statement, a lot of Apple customers are asking, couldn't you just install better batteries? So far, there's been no response from Apple on that yet.
Yeah, it's a good idea. A new battery, huh? I don't know. It's hard to understand these companies. Hey, listen, thanks, Andrew. VOA's Andrew Palchevsky. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
For the first time, farmers in Gaza Strip are harvesting their own pineapples. Not only that, they're much cheaper than what shoppers have been used to. The project, started by a Dutch government with the UN Agriculture Organization, funded 6,000 pineapple saplings. But Gaza's been under an economic blockade while suffering from salty and contaminated water. Musa Al-Jabda oversees the project. He says this type of pineapple saves water in the Gaza Strip and provides a harvest with high economic income for Palestinian farmers. Imported Israeli pineapples cost 15 to 25 shekels, but now fruit shop owner Imad Ashour says shoppers buy the homegrown Gaza product for 5 to 15 shekels. He says poor and rich people can eat it. The first batch of pineapples took 15 months to grow, but it took 4 years to make them good enough to market. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. So good to have you with us today. You know, the holiday season is full of magic, mystery, as well as wonder. More than a century ago, one curious little girl was afraid of some of that magic, that it might not be real. So she wrote a letter to a local newspaper asking, is there a Santa Claus? Well, the response she got back is a holiday classic. Here's more from VOA's Jim Bertel.
The holiday season was a magical time for Virginia O'Hanlon. Born in 1889, she loved the decorations, the food, and the music. But most of all, she loved Santa Claus. When she was 8, one of her friends told her there was no Santa Claus. She waited for her father to come home and asked him if that was true. In Virginia's house, the New York Sun newspaper was an authoritative publication. Her father would say, if you see it in the sun, it is so. So she wrote a letter to the editor of the Sun. Frances Church was a war correspondent during the American Civil War. Now one of the New York Sun's editors, he took Virginia's simple question and wrote what is now considered a literary masterpiece.
Virginia, your little friends are wrong. They have been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They think that nothing can be which is not comprehensible by their little minds. They do not believe what they see. All minds, Virginia, whether they be men's or children's, are little. In this great universe of ours, man is a mere insect, an ant in his intellect, compared with the boundless worlds about him, as measured by the intelligence capable of grasping the whole truth and knowledge. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist. And you know that they abound and give to your life its highest beauty and joy. Alas, how dreary the world would be if there were no Santa Claus. Why, it would be as dreary as if there were no Virginias. There would be no childlike faith then, no poetry, no romance, to make tolerable this existence. We should have no enjoyment except in sense and sight. The eternal light with which childhood fills the world would then be extinguished. not to believe in Santa Claus? Well, you might as well not believe in fairies. You might get your papa to hire men to watch all the chimneys on Christmas Eve to catch Santa Claus. But even if they did not see Santa Claus coming down, what would that prove? Not everybody sees Santa Claus. The most real things in the world are those that neither children nor men see. Did you ever see fairies dancing on the lawn? Of course not. But that's no proof that they are not there. No one can conceive or imagine all the things that are unseen or unseeable in the world. You may tear apart a baby's rattle and see what makes the noise inside. But there is a veil covering the unseen world that not the strongest man, not even the united strength of all the strongest men that ever lived, could tear apart. Only faith, fancy, poetry, love, romance can push aside that curtain and view and picture the supernal beauty and glory beyond. It is all real. Ah, Virginia, in all the world, there is nothing else real and abiding. No Santa Claus. Thank God he lives. And he lives forever. 1,000 years from now, Virginia, nay, 10,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the hearts of children.
Virginia O'Hanlon died in 1971. Thanks to the words of Francis Church, she never stopped believing in Santa Claus. After 20 years after that famous editorial was published, it continues to resonate in the hearts of children young and old. I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
You know, Thursday was the first day of winter here in the Northern Hemisphere. That's a very chilly time of the world, north of the equator. Well, keeping with the holiday theme now, the American band Earth, Wind, and Fire, which has spanned the musical genres of R&B, soul, funk, jazz, as well as disco, pop, rock, Latin, even African, continue to tour just as they did 40 years ago. And guess what? They have a real treat for us now with the song Winter Wonderland. Gotta love their peppy music, makes you want to go walk in the snow. I'm glad it's not snowing here right now, because usually I have to shovel when it's snowing. Well, anyway, it is wintertime. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. Top World News is straight ahead, and we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Daryl Smith, I'm Steve Norman in Washington, and we hope you have a great holiday. Now a bit more of Earth, Wind, and Fire.
And pretend that he's a circus clown. Well, I'm off the front with Mr. Snowman. Later on, we'll conspire.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has announced an additional $130 million in emergency food assistance to Yemen through the U.S. Agency for International Development, known as USAID. This brings the total U.S. contribution in humanitarian aid for the people of Yemen to nearly $768 million since October 2016. The deteriorating humanitarian situation in Yemen is a matter of grave concern for the United States. More than 22 million Yemenis are in dire need of assistance, with more than 8 million on the brink of famine, according to the United Nations. The country has been brought to this state because of the conflict that began in 2015, when Houthi rebels, supported by Iran, seized the capital of Sana'a and drove the internationally recognized government into exile. At the request of the Yemeni government, a coalition led by Saudi Arabia began airstrikes on rebel positions to stop their expansion. Not enough critically needed supplies are reaching the suffering Yemeni people. The United States has repeatedly called on the Saudi-led military coalition to facilitate the free flow of humanitarian aid and commercial imports to all of Yemen's ports and through Sana'a Airport. USAID Administrator Mark Green noted that the small amount of goods that Saudi Arabia has let into Yemen so far is not nearly enough to address the tremendous need. In addition to urging Saudi Arabia to allow humanitarian aid to reach all points where it is needed, the White House has also called on the Iranian-backed Houthi militias to allow food, medicine, and fuel to be distributed throughout the areas they control, rather than diverted to sustain their military campaign against the Yemeni people. The United States urges all parties to the conflict in Yemen to immediately cease hostilities, re-energize political talks, and end the suffering of the Yemeni people. As White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said in a press statement earlier this month, the United States continues to believe that the devastating conflict in Yemen and the suffering it causes must be brought to an end through political negotiations, in accordance with relevant United Nations Security Council resolutions. Successful political negotiations are necessary to ensure that Yemen can flourish, free of the malign influence of Iranian-backed militias operating outside the structures of the state.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.